Barbara Price stood behind Kurtzman's desk, watching the three wall screens monitoring national and international news briefs. Each computer station had its particular section of the overall Stony Man operation to oversee. The tension inside her was a coiling, twisting cobra of uncertainty. Too many things could still go wrong, and she was too damn aware of them. Kurtzman leaned back in the wheelchair with a big hand supporting his chin as he studied the monitor where his banking program was running. Numbers flickered and changed in the half-dozen accounts he was observing in the space of a single heartbeat.
Do they know?
Oh, yeah. I made sure and tripped every bell and whistle I could when I ripped the money out of those accounts. They know.
This is Stony Base. Over.
Stony Base, this is G-Force. We have a go at this end. Stryker has the area lit up like the 4th of July. G-Force out.
Price switched the communications frequency to the one monitored by Able Team in Houston, Phoenix Force on Solitaire Island, and Charlie Mott's team in Tarpon Springs.
Stony Teams, this is Stony Base. Over.
We read you, Stony Base.
We read you, Stony Base.
We read you, Stony Base.
Okay, gentlemen, you have your green light. Stony Base will be standing by. Out.
In her mind, Price was on all four battle sites, fighting beside the men she'd guided there. Her voice was a whisper as she faced the wall screens.
All right, Swain Churchill. Let's see if you're really ready for the big time.
Swain Churchill ran for his life. He dodged blindly, pulled by Terrell Hedges, his personal bodyguard, toward the open door of the manor house, where a trio of his people defended his retreat. Two bodies littered the stone steps, and he had to jump over them to make the entrance. One of the dead men was his. He didn't know who the other one belonged to. Hedges threw him up against the wall inside the house and shielded him with his own body as a hail of bullets tore through the foyer.
Mr. Churchill, you better move your ass or someone's going to shoot it off!
What the hell's going on out there?
Plumes of colored smoke stained the sky as Churchill looked through the window to one side of the door. Hedges grabbed Churchill by the upper arm and started forcing him into another room.
We're under attack!
By whom?
By everyone out there, for starters! And the outer perimeter guards have reported an outside force moving in from the forest!
Churchill freed his arm from Hedges' grip and darted into the library. Reaching into his pocket, Churchill produced a key, fitted it into the locked drawer, and took out the government Model 45 inside. He dropped three extra clips into a jacket pocket. He switched the desk computer on, flipped on the modem, and accessed the Cayman Island banking records. The screen displayed the information in seconds. Even when he saw the evidence for himself, he couldn't believe it. As he worked, all of the bank accounts set up in the names of his associates were being drained, feeding directly into his own account. He watched the numbers flip and saw the millions and millions of dollars piling up.
God damn it!
Sir, these doors aren't going to hold for long.
We'll move when I'm good and ready, and not one moment before.
Yes, sir. It's your ass they want, not mine.
Churchill seated himself at the computer and pulled out the programming book locked in beside the 45. He flipped it open, studied the encoded information, and started to hit the keys. Everything could still be salvaged. He'd been set up. Surely those people out there would believe him after he returned the money. They couldn't let a business as large as the one they'd formed go down the drain because of this. His fingers moved so much more slowly than he wanted them to. He made mistakes and had to go back and try again. Abruptly, the accounts were drained and the screen focused on Churchill's main account. He stared at the numbers, working frantically, then saw them disappear, leaving the account as bare as old Mother Hubbard's infamous cupboard.
Damn it!
Sir!
Churchill ignored the man, lifted the telephone receiver, and punched out the Tarpon Springs number he had for Dan Canary. If there was anyone inside the organization who could have scuttled him so quickly, it was Canary.
They've cut the line!
He threw the dead handset away and stood. His hand slipped under the desktop and tripped a hidden switch. A section of the library shelving slid away, revealing a dark and narrow corridor. He took the flashlight from another drawer and passed it to Hedges. The younger man took the lead at once, trotting into the secret exit. Churchill followed Hedges, trailed by two of his men. There were things he could salvage here once he got away, people who would believe him after they saw how he'd been set up. He could use them, build again. All he needed was time and space to regroup and replan. Holding a linen napkin over her nose and mouth to avoid the tear gas and smoke, Maria Alfaro scrambled through the battleground that had formed around her. The men inside the stone walls had fallen into the every-man-for-himself survival mindset. Groups took potshots at one another from behind whatever available defensive positions they'd been able to find. More men, these clad in black suits with their faces masked by combat cosmetics, came hurtling over the stone walls in groups of twos and threes. They worked in sync, set up positions of covering fire for the next team working forward and cutting through the scattered drug lords and their henchmen like a terrible and swift sword. Still down on her hands and knees, Alfaro clambered under a banquet table laden with food and reached a hand out long enough to seize a Taurus 9mm pistol. Hidden by the folds of the tablecloth, she dropped the magazine and checked how many cartridges she had. 11 shots remained unfired. She wrapped her hand around the large butt of the pistol and screwed up her courage. The black man she'd conned into following her to Churchill's hidden fortress was in the basement of the manor house. With the intense rain of destruction coming down on the home and the grounds, she was afraid he'd be lost in the confusion, another nameless casualty. With everything she'd had to do to make this case, she didn't think she could bear to have his death on her conscience. Enough innocents had been lost or sacrificed. The cocaine she'd taken earlier still buzzed through her system, and she wished it didn't. She pushed herself into a sprinter's position and ran for the house. She'd already seen Churchill and his retinue go through the main entrance, evidently sealing it behind themselves. A small knot of men remained there, trying to force their way through the heavy door. She avoided them, raced near the hedges surrounding the manor house, and kept low until she reached one of the side doors. It was locked, but the window next to it wasn't. Sliding her finger under the casement, she pushed the window up and heaved herself inside. The room was one of the smaller dining rooms scattered throughout the house. Her heart beat frantically as she carefully made her way toward the basement entrance below the main foyer stairs. Perspiration covered the back of her neck. She tried to make her hands stop trembling, but couldn't. She passed four bodies in the hallways, but didn't look closely enough at them to see which side they'd been on. It no longer mattered. The Taurus was in both hands before her, leading every cautious step. A man stood guard at the doorway under the winding stairway leading to the basement. She recognized him as one of Churchill's crew. He carried a CAR-15 canted across his chest and looked ready to use it. Two more of Churchill's private security force manned stations on either side of the wall of windows fronting the house. Most of the glass had been shot out and only jagged shards remained. Seeing her chance, Alfaro ran, moving straight at the man standing beside the basement door. The guide tried to shift when he saw her, whipping the assault rifle toward her. She never broke stride. It was only after she'd slammed into the wall on the other side of the basement entrance that she realized she'd been hit. There was no pain. Between the cocaine and the shock, there was no feeling at all. She pressed her fingers to her side, checked them, and found them covered with blood. Taking a fresh grip on the Taurus, she forced herself to go on. She hurried, afraid she might already be too late, or that the wound might be worse than she thought and suck her into unconsciousness before she made it to the bottom of the steps. Lying on his back on the bed, Leo Turin thought the sharp steel glimmer he saw thrust through his ceiling was the work of an overactive imagination. During the last 8 hours, he'd had plenty of time to wonder exactly what Liborio Perella was going to do with him. His mind had been all too fertile in conjuring up images of a slow, painful death. The steely wink moved slowly. When Turin saw the fine white powder of acoustic tile and sheetrock drift down to layer the carpet, he sat up, pushed himself off the bed, and held a hand under the stream of white dust. It coated his palm immediately. Less than a minute later, the sharp edge had inscribed a circle in the ceiling. It disappeared, and then an Allen wrench poked through the center of the circle and twisted so that the L slid up under the sheetrock. The circle popped free of the ceiling, dropped down for an instant, then was reeled back up into the attic. Turin stepped closer and gazed hard into the black depths of the hole. Charlie Mott, the Stony Man backup pilot for Grimaldi, poked his head down.
Hey, Leo, you about had all the fun here you can stand?
Turin grinned and took the Uzi machine pistol the rugged Canadian passed down. He checked it, found it ready to perform, and dropped the extra magazine into his pockets.
I think so. They tell me I've worn out my welcome.
Well, buddy, you won't exactly be back in good graces when we leave.
The pilot lowered himself into the room. He was tan and fit, with a head of dark curly hair. He wore Stony Man black with combat webbing. Two more Stony Man warriors dropped into the room after him, automatically setting up defensive measures on either side of the room.
So how goes the war?
Mott took up a position beside the window. Before shutting Turin in the room, two of Perella's security squad had dropped a preformed crosshatch of steel bars over the window and locked them into place so that he couldn't escape by that route. The pilot looked over the gently rolling hills that led down to the boathouse and hangar.
We're shutting these people down. That's what took us so long to tend to your rescue. Barb didn't want us to tip our hand before we were ready to move on all fronts. Mason and Ellis have been up in that attic with me for the past 2 hours.
Mason took a hand drill from his leather bag and started working on the door at eye level. Wooden splinters corkscrewed back into the room and littered the carpet. Ellis removed a block of plastic explosive from his gear and began working it into the door casement.
How's that door?
Mason popped the drill from the door and took a small, shiny cylinder from his shirt pocket, which Turin recognized as a peephole. The Stony Man fighter inserted it into the augured hole.
The explosive's ready. Say the word and we're out of here.
I got two guys in the hallway, one on the left and one on the right. The stairway is at 12 o'clock.
Let's get it done.
Mott unfolded an ear-throat headset and settled it into place, then handed one to Turin. The Stony Man black suits put on their sets and took up positions on either side of the door, their H&K MP5 SD3s up and ready.
Falcon, this is Hatchling. Over.
Roger, Hatchling. You have Falcon. Over.
We're about to have our coming out party. Over.
Acknowledged, Hatchling. Falcon standing by. Out.
Mott faced Turin.
The plan is simple. Once we blow those doors, we start moving. And we don't stop moving until we hit that boathouse. I've already spent some time with the pontoon plane down there. It's wired, so we don't have to worry about the key. We're going to be really rushed because we've got to evade these people and try not to get caught by the Federal Task Force Barb has arranged to finish up here.
Turin nodded. Reaching into his pocket again, Mott pulled out a remote control. His thumb hovered over the button, then pressed down. He dropped the control and grinned.
Showtime, people! They just lost the garage and parts of their security perimeters.
Turin braced himself when one of the black suits took out a detonator and slapped it onto the line of C4 on the door. He turned his face away. Peering through the dust, smoke, and splinters, Turin caught a brief glimpse of the black suits rushing through the ragged doorway. Then Mott pushed him into motion. He took a double-fisted grip on the Uzi and ran out into the hall. Mason and Ellis were already securing the stairs. A door opened to Perella's sitting room, and a hard man Turin recognized started to step through with a gun in his fist. Lifting the Uzi, the little Fed squeezed off a stream of 9mm Parabellum rounds. Mott followed up with a grenade. A group of men appeared in the double-wide doorway from the dining room. The Stony Man black suits dropped into defensive postures on the open floor and settled in for the fight. Turin leaned over the stairway railing, a heartbeat ahead of Mott. He emptied the clip. Men fell like tenpins. Turin slapped a palm against the reinforced entrance to Canary's computer room.
Take down this door. Their computer hardware's inside.
Mason and Ellis looked at Mott.
Do it.
Ellis reached into his pocket for more C4. Turin followed the twisting spiral of smoke inside, but no one was there. He reached out to the harness of the Stony Man warrior and unclipped two grenades.
Falcon, this is Hatchling. Over.
Go, Hatchling.
We're ready for that transport. Over.
Acknowledged, Hatchling. Transport is en route. Falcon out.
Turin glanced through the window. Perella's forces were in disarray. Stony Man snipers were cutting them down from hidden positions. The main entrance to Perella's estate blew apart, and a Chevy Blazer four-wheel drive roared through the opening.
Get ready. If you don't get the brass ring the first time, you don't get a ticket to ride.
Turin nodded, wiped his hands on his pants, and took a fresh grip on the Uzi. The Blazer braked to a halt in front of the house. A gunner in the back cut loose with a saw, spitting a stream of 5.56mm rounds across the pockets of resistance formed by Perella's teams. Mott gave Turin a push.
Now!
The little Fed ran for the rear door of the Blazer and dived inside. Hans seized his clothing and shoved him forcibly onto the far side of the seat as Mott went barreling in after him. Mason and Ellis jumped into the rear beside the gunner. Mott slapped the driver on the shoulder.
Go!
The big four-wheel drive dug in, fishtailed for a moment, then straightened, making for the dirt road that led to the boathouse. Mott fired a round from his pistol that tore away the padlock holding the metal gate that closed off the walkway to the pier. The pilot shoved the gate aside and led the rush into the hangar. Turin was at his heels. A glance over his shoulder assured him that the rest of the Stony Man black suits traveling by jeeps were joining them. He followed Mott through the hangar's side entrance and caught the man as he suddenly fell back. Mott was bleeding on his left side from at least two wounds. Crouching to support the man, Turin scanned the interior of the hangar and saw Dan Canary attempting to board the seaplane. Liborio Perella's dark eyes glared at him from the other side of the plane's windscreen. As Dan the man shifted his .45 to cover Turin, the little Fed cut loose with a one-handed figure eight from the Uzi. The 9mm rounds chopped into the man and shoved him back over the nose of the seaplane. Blood smeared across the engine cowling as the body dropped into the dark water. Turin spotted Perella raising an assault rifle through the seaplane's windscreen. Without losing a beat, the Fed shifted his aim. The old mafioso's head snapped back, and he didn't move again.
Don't hurt the goddamn plane!
Are you okay?
Hell no, but help me up anyway so I can get us out of here!
Turin helped support Mott as they made their way to the plane. Mott fired up the engine while someone threw Perella's body onto the wooden walkway.
The doors!
Going now!
Sitting in the co-pilot's seat, Turin saw the series of small explosions rip around the hangar door hinges. In a sheet, hardly disturbed at all, the two heavy doors plunged straight down into the water and disappeared. Mott throttled up and sent the seaplane scooting forward into the lighted rectangle of sky and sea. Once they were clear of the hangar, he increased the craft's power until they were skimming over the water headed for the open sea. Turin watched the ocean drop away as the plane leaped into the air. The ride settled out at once. Within minutes, Perella's estate was fading behind them, swallowed by the distance and the altitude. He reached for the medical kit one of the black suits handed him and started working on Mott's wounds. Neither were life-threatening at the moment.
Looks like we made it. Never had a doubt in my mind.
Turin carefully placed a gauze bandage over the first of Mott's wounds.
Oh, no. Me neither.
Blood flowed down Calvin James's left arm from the bite of the steel cuffs. He stood in the center of the basement, arms chained over his head. He was naked from the waist up, his skin dappled by beads of perspiration. His bare feet were cold against the stone floor. He used the fingers of his right hand to catch the running blood and smear it over his left wrist. The salt from his perspiration stung the rips in his skin, but provided a film of lubricant. Satisfied with the coating, he folded his thumb into his palm and began pulling against the cuff again. He grabbed the cuff with his right hand and added his strength to the combined forces of gravity and his own weight. Pain ran in electric currents from his wrist and surrounded his brain. His body trembled with a sustained effort. For the past 8 hours, he'd been questioned repeatedly. In return, he'd either remained silent or given nonsense answers dealing with Mother Goose stories. For his trouble, he'd been beaten. His right eye was swollen shut, and the inside of his mouth was cut. Every time he swallowed, he tasted blood. He strained against the cuff, pushing the pain away. This was the first time his captors had left him alone. He didn't know when he might get the chance again and wanted to make the most of his present opportunity. His wrist slid another fraction of an inch. Then his left thumb broke. James pulled again, harder, and his hand popped free. He almost blacked out from the pain. Taking deep breaths and forcing them all the way out slowly, the Phoenix Force warrior brought his mind back on track. His broken thumb throbbed as he gazed at it. The flesh around his wrist was torn, bruised, and bleeding. The empty cuff dangled over his head, and drops of blood spattered onto his face as he slid a lockpick free of a secret pocket sewn into his pants. Using his fingers, he worked on the lock of the cuff holding his right hand. The cuff sprang open in a little over a minute. James crossed the room, found a roll of strapping tape near a packing box, and quickly bound his broken thumb to the rest of his hand for support. It limited his freedom of movement, but it also protected the thumb. He located a box knife in a slide drawer just as someone came down the steps. Moving silently, the Phoenix Force commando leaned into the sheltering shadows beside the door. When the man entered the room, James recognized him as one of his interrogators. The man stopped in his tracks, apparently thunderstruck that James could have escaped. Before the man could raise an alarm, James reached out for him with his wounded arm, flicked out the blade of the box knife, and sliced the man's throat open from ear to ear. The ex-SEAL didn't drop his quarry until all struggles had died away. He took the dead man's .45, two extra clips, the buck pocket knife, and his disposable lighter. Someone else was coming. He lifted the .45 and found himself looking down the sights at Maria Alfaro. She had a pistol pointed at him. For an instant, they remained frozen in place, and James could see the cocaine in her system burning holes in her soul. He wasn't sure what kind of grip she had on reality. Finally, she lowered the pistol.
Thank God you're all right. I was afraid I might get here too late.
James got to his feet, not quite putting his pistol away.
What's going on upstairs?
I think your friends have arrived. And Churchill and his people are fighting amongst themselves. I want you to know I didn't have a choice about giving you up to them. They already suspected me. If I couldn't deliver Johnson and I was sure they'd know, I knew I had to give them something to buy myself some time.
So you gave them me?
Yes. You couldn't have gotten here on your own. Maybe your agency wouldn't have found this place if you hadn't been here. I was counting on Churchill to try to figure out who you were. And I was counting on your agency to find a way to track you down. If they didn't, I would have tried to break out on my own.
You took some pretty big chances with my life, lady.
I took some big chances with both our lives. But it had to be done. These people had to be stopped. Too many people are lost every day to drugs as it is now, without Churchill and his group making things even worse.
In spite of everything, James couldn't find it in his heart to blame the woman. There were scars on her soul just as surely as there were scars on his. He was sure she'd lost loved ones to drugs just as he had, and the memory was bitter, something that would always drive them harder than other people. He stepped forward and embraced her.
It's okay. We're gonna beat this thing. Let's get out of here and see if we can help.
Without warning, she buckled in his grasp. He caught her before she fell, seeing her wounds for the first time. Carl Lyons tried to remain casual as he walked onto the docking pier at the Houston Port Authority. Inside, every nerve was thrumming. He thumbed the transmit button on his headset.
Paul, gadgets?
Here, Iron Man. Ready.
Haggerty?
We move when you give us a go-ahead.
From the go, Haggerty, the leader of the squad from Mac Tough, had proved to be a good cop, a team player rather than a maverick. He kept his men in line, and he kept them professional. Instead of trying to go ahead with the assault on the Jolly Jack on his own, as many local law enforcement heads might have wanted to do, Haggerty had been willing to work off Price's calls. It was another facet of the Stony Man mission controller that Lyons respected. She was able to turn up people her teams could work with when it was necessary. The freighter was docked, waiting to be unloaded. Kurtzman had spiked into the Port Authority computer files and rescheduled the Jolly Jack's unloading appointment to better coincide with the strike times of Mott, Phoenix, and Bolin. Lyons carried a clipboard filled with bills of lading and tried to look bored as he closed in on the big ship. He wore a long windbreaker over his combat gear that hung low enough to cover the .357 wheel gun on his hip. A sailor flagged him down from the deck.
You're gonna get us unloaded in this lifetime?
We're working on it! Keep your shorts on!
The mate waved at him in disgust and disappeared over the edge of the deck above Lyons.
Okay, people. Let's get dangerous.
Iron Man watched the hydraulic boom arm come around. He started up the rope ladder the mate had thrown over the side for him, glancing over his shoulder at the ball of cargo netting suspended from the boom arm as it swiveled toward the Jolly Jack. Men clung to the netting with their feet and hands. He didn't see a single weapon among them. As Lyons climbed onto the deck, the mate pointed at the cargo netting over their heads, where a dozen men maintained their holds on the ropes.
Hey, we got our own crew to offload. We don't need those guys.
The port's providing it. Our way of saying we're sorry for the computer error regarding your offloading appointment.
Nearly 20 men sprang from the ship's holds. Not all of them looked like the adventurous seagoing type. The mate stepped forward, going nose to nose with Lyons.
Bullshit! I've been working this harbor a lot of years, and I ain't never heard no shit like this. Who the hell are you?
You know me.
Cops! It's a raid!
The mate's hand darted to the small of his back and removed a chrome pistol. Lyons slapped leather instinctively, the .357 Magnum filling his hand in the wink of an eye.
Sweep the decks!
He lifted the .357 Python and drew target acquisition on his next opponent. His round punched into the man's chest, knocking him into the man behind him. Sniper fire from nearby rooftops chopped into the crew. Men hit the deck, held their positions for a moment, then broke and ran. The men clinging to the cargo netting, Lyons could see Schwartz and Von Canales among them, released their holds and dropped to the deck. Assault rifles and machine pistols up and tracking, they spread out in preformed groups.
Hey, Iron Man!
Lyons glanced over at Blunt Canales and caught the CAR-15 the man tossed to him. He stripped away the windbreaker to reveal the MacTuff uniform underneath.
Good hunting!
Paul took off toward the wheelhouse to prevent any attempts at moving the freighter out of the harbor. Schwartz and a member of the task force cut the cargo netting free. More of Haggerty's people provided covering fire while Schwartz and his assistant lugged the heavy bundle of rope over to the side of the ship. They secured it to the railing with giant S-hooks, then threw the end over. When it trailed down the side of the ship, it formed a broad rope ladder that would allow the rest of the force to clamber aboard. Lyons ran to the nearest hold, leaping over one of the falling bodies, and stopped at the entrance. The bowels of the freighter were unlighted. His four-man team alighted around him, waiting for their orders. He took a pair of night vision goggles from an equipment pack strapped to one man's back and donned them, then slung the CAR-15. Heaving himself over the side, he hung by his hands, then dropped the 15 feet to the floor below. He rolled, raked the assault rifle around, and flipped off the safety. The goggles turned the world green and black. Behind a line of wooden crates, muzzle flashes blossomed bright and deadly. Throwing himself to one side, Lyons rolled and came up with the CAR-15 tucked securely into the crook of his arm. The MacTuff team dropped into the hold with him. Lyons waved two of them to the back to secure the bulkhead and sent the other pair to the port side of the freighter. He kept the starboard side for himself.
Move out! We don't want to miss any of these bastards!
Lyons moved at a slow jog, the rifle ready in his hands.
Haggerty?
We're in. We're driving them to you now.
Two crewmen raced toward Lyons, glancing over their shoulders. They didn't see the Able Team warrior until they were almost on top of him. Lyons rose out of his crouch. Guiding the second man into position with his empty hand, Lyons took a set of plastic cuffs from his equipment belt and secured the guy's hands behind his back, then did the same for the first man.
Haggerty! Be careful! They know we're here now!
Lyons watched the crew trying to regroup.
Paul?
Yeah, Iron Man.
How's the wheelhouse?
We own it. This crate isn't going anywhere.
Lyons peered over the top of the boxes he used for cover at what was left of the crew. From his hurried count, he figured there might be 20 survivors. He raked a smoke grenade from his webbing, pulled the pin, and heaved the orb into the middle of the men.
That was just a smoker, gents. Think of what could have just happened. I'm giving you people exactly 30 seconds to pack it in, or I'm going to introduce you to the real thing. You're down to 20 seconds.
How do we know you guys won't cut us down anyway?
You've got my word on it. You want that in writing? You're gonna have to drop the weapons anyway, and you're down to 10 seconds.
All right. We're coming out.
Any tricks? If any one of you is holding out thinking you're gonna break free, you all die. That's a promise, too.
After a moment, another handful of weapons dropped into the pile taking shape outside the crates.
Okay. Everybody out and onto their faces. The sooner we get this part over with, the better the chances are that nobody else needs to get hurt.
The crewmen walked warily out into the open, then sank to their knees and onto their stomachs, placing their hands behind their heads. Five men from the MacTuff group closed in and quickly cuffed the sailors. Within minutes, they had the men up and moving toward the upper deck. Lyons interviewed one of them long enough to find out where the psilocybin cocaine was hidden, then followed them up. Holding on to the LCU's railing, Katz scanned the shore of Solitaire Island. They were still a quarter mile out to sea, but the security around the harbor had already started to tighten in response. At first, they'd been hailed by ship-to-shore radio from August's communications people. Katz had ignored the repeated commands to identify themselves. Once the LCU had powered up close enough to be seen, the communications had died away. There was no mistaking the military lines of the landing craft. Two speedboats were cutting swaths through the sea, tracking onto the LCU. Katz's field glasses had revealed mounted 50-caliber machine guns on board both vessels. Katz hit his transmitter.
Phoenix 2 and Phoenix 4, this is Phoenix 1, over.
Roger, Phoenix 1, you got Phoenix 2, over. I do have Phoenix 4, over.
Take your targets down. Phoenix 1, out.
The mined airfield and warehouse went up. Debris blew straight up. The munitions had been planted with that effect in mind, because it would let everyone on the island know that the sea didn't pose the only threat. Katz put the binoculars away and hunkered down slightly.
Helmsman, full throttle!
The landing craft shuddered as the powerful engines were kicked into full thrust. The LCU's nose dropped down into the water for an instant, then popped back up and plunged forward. 40 SEALs and 6 Jeeps were on the LCU with Katz, bringing the invasion force up to 70 men. The USS Spearfish was standing by with a secondary wave if necessary.
Gunner, you have your target.
The SEAL rose to his position at the deck-mounted 40-millimeter machine cannon as the first of the speedboats raced toward them. The second boat turned tail and tried to run. Katz glanced at the harbor. Someone was out there trying to consolidate the security forces so that they could make a stand. Black smoke curled up from the wreckage of the airfield and the warehouse. The shore guns kicked sluggishly into action, drawing great gouts of water from the sea in a searching pattern that was closing in on the LCU. He thumbed the transmit button. They were less than 200 yards from the shore.
Come in, Phoenix 3. Over.
You're Phoenix 3. Over.
It's time to bring down the curtain. Over.
Acknowledged. Phoenix 3 out.
Katz rose from his crouch slightly. The success of Manning's theories was the linchpin that would tell how costly the invasion was going to be in lives for the Navy and Phoenix Force. He waited. A round from one of the big shore guns rocked the landing craft when it hit only yards away. A wave of water erupted over the side and drenched the attack unit. White foam billowed up and around the island. The people on land acted as if they were experiencing an earthquake as the ground beneath them buckled and shivered. Without warning, a chasm opened up, splitting through the main house and shaking down the outbuildings. Men, sand, trees, and buildings dropped into the chasm as if filling a vacuum.
Helmsman, take us ashore!
The LCU adjusted its approach and hurtled onto the beach. The debarkation teams kicked down the boarding ramp and poured out onto the sand. Katz took the shotgun seat in the lead Jeep, clapping the driver on the shoulder to let him know the machine gunner had joined them. The Jeep hurtled out of the LCU, jumped over the ramp, and bucked onto the loose sand of the harbor area. The gunner with the deck-mounted 40mm cannon kept firing into the buildings, and explosions ripped through the structures. The SEAL driver heeled around the corner of a demolished building, pursuing a ground team that had used LAW rockets to take out two of the invading Jeeps. Katz got a brief impression of a yellow wall that was swelling up over him, then realized he was looking at a bulldozer. The driver tried to stop, but there wasn't time. Belted into the Jeep, Katz rode out the crash, then cut himself free. He secured his grip on the MAC-10 and joined the firefight. The magazine empty on the machine pistol, Katz let it hang by its strap as he reached for his sidearm. The Sig Sauer P226 settled onto the head of the driver of the approaching bulldozer. Katz stood his ground. When he was finished, the hole in the cab's windshield could have been covered by an 8-inch pie plate. The driver crumpled to the cab's floor.
Yakov, bloody hell, mate, are you all right?
Katz turned and saw McCarter running toward him.
Seem to be.
McCarter paused by the prone body of the SEAL gunner and pressed his fingers to the man's throat. He glanced up and shook his head. But the driver was only stunned. Katz helped the man limp to the meager shelter of the flattened outbuilding and gave him the M16 he'd been issued. Enciso joined Katz, blood leaking from a corner of his mouth.
Web August is getting away.
Where?
That way.
Following the direction the Cuban indicated, Katz saw a four-wheel drive pickup charging into the jungle. No one was there to intercept it. The Israeli put his shoulder to the hood of the Jeep.
David, Raphael, your assistance, please.
The three Phoenix commandos bent to the task, pushing and shoving the Jeep until it rolled over onto all four tires. McCarter slid behind the wheel and keyed the ignition. Action in the harbor was dying down as the SEALs secured their beachhead. Katz turned control of the invading forces over to the Navy SEAL team commander. Wrenches whipped into their faces as they plunged into the jungle. McCarter had to struggle with the wheel as he steered around trees and boulders. Unexpectedly, they plunged through a wall of bush and thumped onto a dirt trail.
Oh, obviously we missed something.
I thought August looked like someone who had a definite destination in mind.
Save the recriminations for the after-the-game analysis. These blokes haven't put anything past us yet.
200 yards farther, the trail ended abruptly. Katz led the way out of the Jeep into the clearing on top of a small, steep rise. Six men were about to climb aboard a Bell helicopter, which had been shielded by a canopy of camo netting. The helicopter's rotors were spinning, rotor wash flailing away at leaves and branches. A man raised an assault rifle to his shoulder and squeezed off a burst. Enciso cut the gunner down with a tri-burst. Sunlight lanced into the clearing as the camo netting fell to one side. Webb August tried to crawl inside the helicopter while blindly firing his assault rifle one-handed. Taking up a position behind a tree, Katz jerked a grenade from his webbing, pulled the pin with his hook, counted down silently, then lobbed the bomb under the helicopter.
Fire in the hole!
There were no survivors. Having hit the stone wall at a dead run, Mac Bolan used the grappling hook and nylon rope to climb to the top. He paused for a moment on the wall, then was face to face with Cowboy Kissinger on the other side. Both men slipped on their gas masks. The warrior hit the transmit button on his headset.
Snipers, report.
1 able, sir. 2 able, sir. 3 able, sir.
Be advised that you have friendlies in the field as of now.
Bolin rolled, dropped to the ground, and raised the Mossberg pump as an Uzi-wielding hardman wheeled on him. The 37mm smoke canisters discharged by the Smith & Wesson riot control guns continued to blow red, black, and yellow streamers into the air, mixed with the white CS gas. Bolin turned. A military jeep carrying more SAS troops came barreling into the yard. 4 more would follow in seconds. They were the second wave of the attack, which would establish a spearhead that would claim the battleground. He thumbed the transmit button on his headset.
Third team, you have your go.
He glanced at the treetops 1,000 yards away and saw Grimaldi's chopper rise from the dark sky like a giant black-eyed insect. 2 more followed it, forming a flying wedge that was more for intimidation than anything else. Helicopter fire inside the primary kill zone could end up injuring the friendly forces on the scene. Bolin went to ground behind a concrete fish pond as a fresh wave of auto fire searched for him. The warrior crawled on his hands and knees, maintaining his grip on the Mossberg. He came up without warning, bracketing the window where the gunners were taking cover. He pushed himself to his feet and raced toward the manor house with Kissinger at his heels. He slammed into place alongside the door and brought the shotgun up. Bolin looked at the weaponsmith.
Now.
Whirling inside, the warrior took the left side while Kissinger covered the right. 2 of Churchill's men tried to break from the window.
Stryker, you okay?
Yeah, Kevlar, but ow.
Bolin and Kissinger made their way down the hallway. They dropped their gas masks onto the floor because they were no longer necessary. The snipers had confirmed Churchill's re-entry into the house. No one had seen the man come out. At the end of the hallway, Bolin found 2 men facing a closed door. One of them was working on the door with a fire axe.
Drop your weapons.
The men turned, doing as they were told.
Where's Churchill?
In there. There's a way out of here. A passageway leading to an escape tunnel and a Land Rover. The son of a bitch ran out on us.
Bolin waved the muzzle of the Mossberg meaningfully.
Down on the floor.
The men got down and lay there while Bolin cuffed them.
Take out the door, cowboy.
The big man nodded, slung his assault rifle, and delved into a pouch tied at his waist. He pinched off a section of a block of C4 and stuck it to the door by the locking mechanism. Then he added a detonator switch and ducked back. When Kissinger waved the smoke away, the lock had been replaced by a big hole. Bolin dumped his prisoners in the hallway, then lifted a foot and kicked the door in. The room was empty.
Damn! I hate these lock room mysteries.
Slinging the Mossberg pump gun over his shoulder, Bolin advanced to the library shelves. He built the house in his mind, tore it down, and figured the most likely wall to house a concealed entrance.
Here.
He started scooping books from the shelves directly behind the desk. Unsheathing his cold steel Tonto knife, he tapped the butt against the wooden panels behind the shelves.
I'm covering the door.
Bolin nodded, already busy with a block of C4. He ran lines at the top and bottom of the hidden entrance, then wired in a single detonator to both pieces of the plastic explosive. Activating the remote control, he jogged back out of the room and took up his position in the hallway.
Stryker!
Looking up, the warrior saw Calvin James stumble into the hallway from the other end. He looked worse for the wear, but he was walking on his own 2 feet and carrying a woman in his arms. A glance showed Bolin that the woman was Alfaro.
She needs medical attention. It's pretty bad. And I've done all I can for her without medical supplies.
He came to a halt in front of them.
Let me take her off your hands. You look plumb tuckered out.
Major Adair, this is Stryker.
Go, Stryker.
The executioner watched James sag against the wall when Kissinger relieved him of the woman.
I need a medevac unit, double quick. 2 to transport, inside the house.
Good people?
Yeah.
They're on the way.
James nodded toward the library. The .45 hung at the end of his arm. Even banged up, he still looked game enough to take on whatever came his way.
Churchill in there?
Was.
Bolin thumbed the remote control.
I'm gonna find out where he went.
I'll go with you.
You'll stay here and wait for that medevac team. I can't afford to look out for you and me both down there.
James squared his shoulders and started to protest, but realized the truth in the statement. Taking up the shotgun, Bolin glanced at Kissinger.
I got him. You watch your ass down there.
Bolin turned and charged into the room, ran sure-footed over the debris, and paused at the side of the gaping hole in the wall. Darkness swirled inside, riding the clouds of dust that had been stirred up by the explosion. Taking a halogen flashlight and a roll of electrical tape from his pouch, he fixed the flash to the Mossberg's barrel and switched it on. He went in low, keeping his back to one of the hand-hewn stone walls.
Stryker!
Go!
We're taking your people out right now. Mind if I drop in on your little party?
Come ahead, Major.
Seconds later, the bulky body of the SAS commander shadowed the library entrance. Bolin went on. The tunnel sloped down, widening as the hewn walls gave way to a small cave. The smell of limestone and mildew was thick and cloying. He continued to sweep the beam of the flash across the walls, but saw nothing. Less than a minute later, he hit bottom. No one was there. Playing the flashlight's beam around the small cavern, Bolin discovered he was in a room almost 50 feet square. A stream flowed from the northwest, emerging from under a rocky wall and continuing down a tunnel running southeast. The water was dark, murky when the light touched it, but it looked deep enough to float a good-sized longboat. Dull metal gleamed on the walls, and further inspection revealed them to be ring bolts set into the stone. A rusted anchor leaned in one corner among the scattered remains of a half-dozen wooden kegs and a rolled bunch of sailcloth. Adair's flashlight beam joined the executioners.
Smuggler's den. Once an honored profession in this country. You find them in a lot of places. Your man Churchill really plays for all the angles, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Bolin moved out to scout the terrain. A dark patch glistened on the stone floor. When he touched it, oil came away on his fingers. He jogged a short way along the narrow ledge following the stream and tried to look farther down the tunnel, but the flashlight beam was lost in the intense dark lying in wait there.
No telling how far that bleeding tunnel goes.
It's got to come out somewhere. Send a foot patrol along after him.
Bolin and Adair raced back to the library.
They must have some kind of vehicle. That was motor oil I saw on your hand back there, wasn't it?
Bolin nodded as they came out into the lighted library. He took his map case from a slit pocket of the skin suit. Flipping through the information concerning this part of Dover, he took out a geological survey map and laid out the document.
I want the team sent along to flush out Churchill if the guy tries to hole up instead of making a run for it. I'm hedging my bets.
But you think he'll run?
Yeah. From the coastline, it's a 21-mile jump across the Strait of Dover into France. If he gets that far, we could be looking at a whole new ballgame. Parts of that cave and tunnel appear to have been hewn out by hand.
That's not unusual. As I said, privateering was a lucrative business in the 16th and 17th centuries.
Bolin sorted out another geological survey map, which zeroed in on the area surrounding Churchill's manor house.
True, but I believe that particular tunnel has access to the sea.
You still have to find the other end of that rabbit warren in time, mate.
Bolin put the maps away.
Churchill's not going to escape. His chances of being able to rebuild this organization after the way we've shattered it are slim, but I want to leave him no chance at all.
Bolin changed the headset to the frequency monitored by the Stony Man troops and tapped the transmitter button.
Jack.
Go, Sarge.
Meet me out front.
On my way.
Bolin ran through the house until he reached the front entrance. The battle in the yard had died away to sporadic gunfights. The SAS teams were obviously very much in control of the situation. Calvin James and Kissinger were beside a gurney, working feverishly on Maria Alfaro. An SAS corpsman held up a plastic bottle of glucose while the fluid fed into the woman's arm.
How is she?
She'll make it. She's a hell of a tough lady.
Bolin could tell the woman had made an impression on the ex-SEAL and wondered what the full story was. Price hadn't seemed well informed concerning James's actions during the final stages of the mission. Kissinger looked up and squinted at Grimaldi's approaching helicopter.
Going somewhere?
I'm gonna tie up a loose end.
You want company?
I've got Jack. You're needed here.
He moved out at a jog away from the medical team so the rotor wash wouldn't create problems. Grimaldi had dropped the helicopter to within a few feet of the ground. Bolin leaped, caught the landing skid and hauled himself up, dropping into the co-pilot's seat and putting on a headset. Grimaldi pulled up on the stick and the main rotor grabbed airspace.
Where to?
Southeast.
The executioner quickly outlined the discovery of the smuggler's den below the manor house. At full speed, the helicopter winged toward the coastline.
That's a lot of area to cover.
Streams and rivers usually find the easiest route to the major bodies of water. On the map, some of them appear to twist and turn, but if you follow them for a couple of miles on foot, they tend to head more or less straight. It's 2 miles from the house to the coastline. I'm betting whoever first established the smuggler's hideout chose this location because it was the easiest to travel and had direct access to the sea.
And the shortest distance between two points is a straight line.
That's what I'm thinking.
I'll buy it.
Moments later, the coastline came into view. Grimaldi lost altitude, then skimmed low over the water while they searched the chalk cliffs for their quarry.
There! I thought I saw something flash at 10 o'clock.
Bolin turned his binoculars to the direction indicated, adjusted the magnification, and saw an open-topped, military-styled Land Rover scaling the cliff face along a road that was almost non-existent. He strengthened the magnification again, swept the two faces inside, and found Churchill sitting in the passenger seat.
It's Churchill. They've got to come up.
Boland put the binoculars to his eyes again. He scouted the twisting road the Land Rover was following and found where it peaked off the cliff face. He pointed.
We'll be down there. Sarge! There's no other way. This helicopter makes a big target. If Churchill gets by us, it'll take too long to organize a ground interception. By then, he could be long gone.
The pilot heeled the helicopter over. It moved like a live thing in his hands, dropping with express elevator speed toward the top of the cliff, where the wind and the sea had scoured the land clear of vegetation. Boland dumped the Mossberg, knowing that the pellets would prove ineffectual against the Land Rover's windshield. He doffed the headset and swung himself out the door as Grimaldi brought the craft to a shuddering halt a dozen feet above the ground. The executioner jumped, rolling and pushing himself to his feet on impact. Grimaldi cleared off, stirring up a cloud of dust and stinging sand that pelted Boland's exposed flesh. The warrior sprinted to meet the vehicle, driving his legs hard against the ground. He came to a halt where the road suddenly switched back and left a dangerous curve, where nothing but sheer cliff face and broken rocks waited 100 feet below. Boland drew the Desert Eagle as the Land Rover topped the last ridge less than 50 feet away. Dirt crumbled under his boots, and for an instant he thought he'd placed himself too close to the edge of the cliff. Then the ground held. On the other side of the holed glass, Swain Churchill gestured wildly. The driver pressed down on the accelerator, closing the distance to 40 feet, then 30. Boland guessed the driver intended to take him out with some kind of sideways skid. The executioner stood his ground and brought the driver's head and shoulders into target acquisition as the Land Rover plunged toward him. Coolly, the executioner stroked the trigger of the big 44 and pumped a trio of shots into the driver. The windshield came apart and the driver slammed back into his seat, his head in fragments. The Jeep careened out of control. Boland suddenly realized he was trapped by the wall of steel hurtling at him. There was nowhere else to go but the sea and a drop straight down to the rocks.
Search!
The helicopter came up out of a diving swoop and hovered even with the cliff's edge. Boland dropped his pistol and jumped as the tumbling Land Rover closed in on him. There was a stomach-turning moment of freefall, and his hands closed around the helicopter skid. He glanced down to see the rear of the Land Rover plunging toward the sea and waiting rocks.
I'd say the blue chip stock in the drug market just hit bottom unexpectedly.
Boland hauled himself aboard the helicopter. He settled back in the seat and watched the fire disappear behind the cliff as Grimaldi guided the helicopter back toward the manor house.
Churchill's gone, but not the game. There's too much power and money to be made walking on the dark side. All we've done is buy the world a little time until the next predator comes along.
Somehow it doesn't seem like enough.
It has to be enough, because it's all you get.
People had been fighting that dark side within and outside of themselves since the dawn of mankind. It was that fight that made the war everlasting. And as long as he felt he could make a difference fighting that dark side, the executioner knew he'd keep himself on the front line. It was the only true home the warrior had ever known. Stony Man 5 is a graphic audio production. Stony Man is a trademark owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 1992, Worldwide Library. Production copyright 2008, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Michael Glenn, Thomas Penny, Christopher Walker, Christopher Graybill, Nanette Savard, David Coyne, Jeff Baker, Richard Rowan, Ken Jackson, James Lewis, James Konacek, Eric Messner, Dylan Lynch, Kate Torrey, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. With additional original music by Chris Rowan, Dan Smith, and Matt Webb. Book adapted for graphic audio by Wilson T. Farrier. Directed by Dan Smith. Dialogue editing by Brian Patton. Graphic audio sound design by Brian Patton, Greg Reinfeld, and Brian Rogers. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. The Stony Man theme was composed by Mark Ashby. If you enjoyed Stony Man, be sure to look for Don Pendleton's Mac Bolan and Ryder Stacy's Doomsday Warrior, available at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free screensavers, desktops, ringtones, and games.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.